Steve, I know you can appreciate my slide.
Okay.
It was not accidental that I chose this for the theme on this. The disciples are going to have a building knowledge about Jesus' resurrection. They start out at ground zero. It is going to build. But as we start on this, I'd like to tell a little story about my mother. I was a late in life child, so I was rather young when I was born, and my parents were a little older. And my mother was very serious about wanting to encourage me to read. And so one of the things that she would do from the point that I first started being able to read was she would get started in a story, and she could really make a story exciting. And then all of a sudden, she had to make dinner, she had to do this, she had to do the other thing, and I would be begging her, when can we finish the story? And she'd say, John, you can read it. Why don't you read it to me? And so she was really good at building the suspense and getting me to look at the text, you know, to get into a book and to find out what was in it. And my wife will testify that I am a bookkeeper. That is, I do collect quite a library. But let's see, which button is it that I'm wanting? I'm doing the right button.
I believe you are. Let me make sure I turned it on.
There's a little button on the side of it.
Okay. Sure.
And is that right there? Well, we got no power here.
Well, is it your fault?
You need batteries?
No, I just put new batteries in it. When you click at it, I'll hit the button.
Very good. Okay, you can click it. My mother used to enjoy watching Perry Mason. She used to enjoy reading Agatha Christie books. But you know, one of the things that I would do is I'd go to the end of the book and read and find out what it was. But one of the problems is we know the ending of the Gospel of John. We are too familiar with it. And as a result of our familiarity, we have a hard time putting ourselves in the position of the early readers. I'd like to now acquaint you with a good friend, actually good friends of ours. This is Frank Tyler. He is 6'8".
Wow.
And he's the person that, well, let's say, I was able to acquaint him with the Gospel of John, but he's the one that got us to start thinking about 10,000 at a time. And I'll tell you one occasion where he whetted the appetite of a man that he was talking to and wanting to introduce the living water. So they had an introductory conversation, and then he said to this man that he was wanting to give him this Gospel of John. And the man said, well, I'm an atheist. I have no interest. And that didn't stop Frank at all. What Frank said to him was, you know, you and I are perhaps more similar than you might think. You have devoted your whole life and you have come to the conclusion that there is no God. And as I have lived my life and investigated, I have concluded that there not only is a God, but that God gives everlasting life as a gift to those who believe in his Son for it. Then he asked him, if you could know that you would live forever, would that be something you'd like to know? The man said, yeah, that would be a good thing to know. Frank said, this book is designed to make a case not only for God, but the God who gives everlasting life so that you could know that you would live forever.
Amen.
And the man said, I will read it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to whet people's appetites and not take away the suspense that there is within the book. It is designed to reach people where they are and to carry them to the point of knowing that they have everlasting life because of having believed in Jesus for it. Next slide. Now, but it really is important to know the Gospel of John well. That will help us to be able to share the message. So we're going to go through the eight signs, but we're going to go through it in a little different way. You'll notice that this forms ABC all the way to I. So we have agua, boy, cot, dinner, E.T., and so on. In John chapter 2, Jesus turned agua into wine.
Wine.
Very good. And then in John chapter 4, there was a nobleman who had a boy off in Capernaum, and Jesus healed him from a distance instantaneously. So, agua, boy. When Jesus in John chapter 5 was with the man who was by the pool of Siloam, waiting for the stirring of the water so that he would be healed, he asked the man if he wanted to be healed. And he said, well, I don't have anyone to put me into the water. And Jesus told him, stand up, pick up your
cot,
or actually mat, but cot works better for the mnemonic. Pick up your mat and walk. Then in John chapter 6, Jesus fed the 5,000 men plus women and children out of the 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And so that's dinner. Then you might wonder about E.T. Jesus that night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, came walking on the sea towards his disciples. And they were rowing. When you're rowing, you're looking back over the stern of the boat, the direction from which Jesus came. They said, it's a ghost. It's an extraterrestrial. Well, no, it was Jesus. So, we come down to E.T. Jesus walked on water. Then, you remember in John chapter 9, as Jesus was leaving the temple, he saw a man born from birth. And what did the disciples say? Who sinned, this man or his father, that is his parents, that he was born blind? So the father's fault. Then you remember in John chapter 11, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. And then we have the two-part sign of the cross and resurrection. The cross I put down as homicide. And then in John chapter 20, I'm back. The resurrection. So it makes it an easy way to remember these. I think it's pretty easy to go through and say, agua, boy, cot, dinner, E.T., father's fault, grave, razor, homicide, and I'm back. As an easy way to remember this. The more familiar we are with John, it makes it so that when we talk with someone, we can take them to a passage that might capture their fancy. Just knowing the book will help us to be able to introduce the book in a way that will cause people to look more seriously at it. So here are the 7 signs. I've got them down in the notes, but let's do a test. Next one. Next slide. So, what are the 8 signs? Agua is
water to wine.
Boy, Jesus healed the nobleman's son. Then caught the lame man who had been lame 38 years in John 5. Dinner, feeding 5,000. E.T. And then father's fault. And grave razor. Homicide, and I'm back. Okay, so it's easy to remember that. You can attach the chapters to it, and it'll make it easier to just hang on to the whole book. So now, We are told on a number of occasions that the disciples did not believe that Jesus would be resurrected because they didn't believe that he was going to be killed. Let's look at some passages in order to set this up. Next slide. And so this is basically the outline for the rest of the first page. If we turn to John chapter 2, Jesus came to Jerusalem for the Feast of Passover, and in the process, he cleansed the temple. He chased out the money changers and those who were selling the animals. And we're told that in verse 17, his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." Verse 18, we now get the objectors. So the Judeans answered and said to him, "What sign do you show to us since you do these things?" Notice they have used the word sign. Because of Deuteronomy chapter 18, they knew that someone with the authority of a prophet or greater had to have signs verifying that God had sent him. So they asked for the proof that he has the authority. What sign do you show us? Notice Jesus answers their question. So when he says, "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up," he is identifying the cross and the resurrection as the validating sign proving his right to cleanse the temple. Now, he's not saying, 3 years from now I'm going to do a sign. You have to wait around for 3 years. Let's look at context a little bit. Look down at verse 23. In verse 23, we are told that while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, during the eight-day feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. He was doing signs at that time. But what he's pointing to with "destroy this sanctuary and in 3 days I will raise it up," that is the greatest of all the signs. Turn also to John chapter 3, verse 1. This occurs while Jesus was in Jerusalem for the feast. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Judeans. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." So when Jesus says, there's one sign that proves my authority to do this, he wasn't saying you have to wait 3 years for that. There were signs he was already doing, but he said there's one in particular for you to look for. But as we go a little further into that context, notice the Judeans object. A better translation of this: this sanctuary has been built 46 years. We can date that working back through Josephus. We're able to date all this. We are up to the year 30, and 46 years has elapsed since the completion of the holy place and the Holy of Holies, which is what John calls the sanctuary. But now notice John's clarification in verse 21. But he was speaking of the sanctuary of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, 3 years later, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. They did not understand that he would die, and if they didn't understand he was going to die, they saw no need for him to be resurrected. Now let's go to John chapter 12 for the second of these points, and let's see how the populace looked at this issue. John chapter 12. In John chapter 12, Jesus speaks after the Father has spoken to him, and people have heard the voice, but they don't really know what to make of it. But look at verse 30. Jesus answered and said, this voice that was in the previous verse, in verse 28, did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And if I am lifted up, that's a reference to the cross, I will draw all to myself. John clarifies, this he said, signifying by what death he would die. He would not be stoned to death. He would not have any bones broken. He would be put to death with a Roman crucifixion that would be completely in accord with what the Bible had prophesied. But notice the objection that comes in verse 34. The people answered him, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. And how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? They said, you've just contradicted your claim to be the Messiah. Because the Messiah has to live forever, and you're talking about dying. But what they didn't get was, he would die first, be resurrected, and continue forever. Messiah is able to reign forever after being resurrected. Resurrection is being posed in John as extremely important. We've seen it as the most important of the signs. The one that he pointed towards 3 years ahead was going to validate. Now he's the answer to the people is ultimately he's going to reign forever. He's going to live forever after being resurrected, but he dies first. Now let's look at John the Baptist. And this is one time that we won't be just staying in John. And the reason that we're moving around a bit is I want to set up the importance or the understanding that the disciples had. So let's turn to Matthew chapter 11. This is a passage that I think has often been misunderstood, because it's often thought that John the Baptist was beginning to doubt that the revelation he had gotten, that this was the Christ, that he's starting to back off on that and say, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I didn't get revelation from God. But I don't think that's the case at all. Matthew chapter 11, starting at verse 1. Now it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that he departed from there to teach and preach in their cities. And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to him, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? That's often been, are you legit, or are you a fake? Not what he's asking at all. From Qumran, we know that even in the first century, Jews were entertaining the idea that there were possibly two different messiahs. They spoke about a messiah ben Joseph, a suffering messiah, and they would look at passages like Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22 talking about him, and then they saw a completely different person, Messiah ben David, who would be the triumphant one. I think that John is saying, is there one of you, or are there two of you? And what Jesus said was, I do what the one Messiah will do. Look at verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, for them to relay back to John, go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. One of the things when you play 20 questions with Jesus, you wish you could ask 21 questions. And the logical question would be, okay, well, how many times are you going to come? John didn't get an answer to that question. Yes, he's coming back. But the issue of would he die had been a tremendous problem for the Jewish scholars to wrestle with. And that's why they proposed that there would be two messiahs, one who would die and one who would live forever and reign. But what we have is one person who does both. He dies, then he will live forever, and he will reign forever. So now let's look at Matthew chapter 16. In Matthew 16, we see a very high point in Peter's life, because Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ. We all recognize this passage. Now, I'm following the majority text, so my wording will be a little different than some of yours at one very small point. Matthew 16, starting at verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" The word "I" belongs in there, but many of your translations will not have it. And what I see Jesus saying here, as I put it into the notes, what do people think when I call myself Son of Man? This was a term that Jesus had never defined. And he's giving an ordination exam to his disciples. And the first answer that they give is what Herod Antipas thought, that it was Jesus is John the Baptist risen from the dead. So they say, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, or others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. In the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel is called by God Son of Man about 90 times. So it seems that they might have thought, maybe that's that Jesus is just saying, I'm a prophet, like Ezekiel. So now what Jesus did was he asked, but who do y'all, and it's a plural, who do y'all say that I am? Or in Australia, they would correct me and say it's guys.
That's New Jersey.
The question now I would understand it is, what do you think that I mean when I call myself Son of Man? Remember, the overriding question is, who do people think that I, the Son of Man, am? So the follow-up would be, what do you think that I mean when I call myself Son of Man? And Peter gives a wonderful answer. And this, as I point out in the notes, is not when he came to faith. He did that way back in John chapter 1, and he was one of the disciples who in John 2:11 was said to have believed in Jesus already. This is not the point that he's coming to faith, but he is saying, this is how I understand you when you call yourself Son of Man. He's thinking of Daniel chapter 7 and the heavenly Son of Man, the one who's going to come in power. And so in verse 16, Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." That's what you mean when you call yourself Son of Man. You're Daniel's heavenly Son of Man. Now, Peter is at a real high point. And listen to the commendation he gets from Jesus. Verse 17, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now let's look at where Peter immediately starts to have a problem. Verse 21, "From that time Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you.'" He's caught the identity of Jesus, but he's saying, "You can't die. You're wrong." Jesus' response is not well understood. I'm going to point out a play on words that is universally missed by our translations. You'll notice in verse 23, the word "behind." All of your translations say, "Get behind me, Satan." That word that's translated "behind" is It also appears in the very next verse, and it is there translated after. Exactly the same word. What I would see Jesus saying here is, go after me. Now, do you want your adversary behind you? Is that a good place if you're fighting? To have your adversary behind you? Why would he want him to get behind him? He's saying, resume discipleship. Resume following. Stop trying to lead. As long as you're trying to lead me, you are my adversary. Satan, I think here should be understood, I think it should be translated. It's adversary. I don't think it should be a capitalized S. We're not thinking of the devil. What he's saying is, you're my adversary. Stop being my adversary. Stop trying to lead. Resume following. Start listening again. Because notice how he phrases it as he speaks to all of his disciples in verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me. Okay, if the rest of you want to line up behind Peter and resume discipleship, the rest of the disciples were thinking what Peter said. He said, if you want to resume, come on. Start following. Listen to what I have to say. Stop trying to oppose me with what I've said. Jesus is the greater than Moses prophet like Moses. His words have to be 100% true, and Peter has, in essence, called him false prophet. Peter's not thinking very hard about his words. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Resume discipleship. Peter could score A+ in identifying who is Jesus, but then completely mess it up when it comes to Jesus speaking an uncomfortable truth. Okay, next slide. And we'll turn the page. After the cross, but before the resurrection, that's what ACBR stands for. After the cross, but before the resurrection, it's in your notes. What did the 11 not believe about his death and resurrection? We're told that they did not believe the resurrection, but that doesn't tell us exactly what they did believe. Now, if I say that the assailant didn't escape in a green car, maybe he escaped in a brown horse. You know, we automatically assume that we know what something is when someone says it's not this, but there are a lot of possibilities as to what they actually believe. And I think that we'll start to see clues as to what the disciples actually did believe. They didn't believe in his resurrection, but now they're confronted after the cross. Something has to happen to Jesus. But they still didn't believe the resurrection. Now, we know about doubting Thomas, and we know how he said, I've got to put my fingers in the wounds, I've got to put my hand where the spear went, and until then I will not believe in the resurrection of Jesus. But now I'd like for us to turn to Mark 16, and we're going to turn to a passage that some of your Bibles have notations saying that they don't think that these verses belong in the Bible. And there also are some problematic verses that people have really struggled with. I make no apologies for this passage. I fully accept it as being part of the New Testament. And I do not see any heresy in it whatever. You'll notice that I've put my email address if you want me to send you an article that someone else wrote but I edited. I can do that. It will... I go into more detail about what I'm talking about on this page. Now, notice in verses 6 through 8 that after the resurrection of Jesus, the angels are talking to the women who have come. They're described in verse 1 of chapter 16. And the angel said to the women, at verse 6. Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they have laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he said to you. So they went away quickly. Sounds good so far. And fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Fear shut their mouths. Now we get into the section that people question whether it should be here. In verses 9 through 11, we're told that the 10 disbelieved Mary Magdalene's assertion that she had seen Jesus. Verse 9, now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast 7 demons. She went out and told those who had been with him as they mourned and wept. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe. We've got rejection by the 10. But interestingly, the 10 include the Apostle John. And as I put in the notes, prior to the point where Mary Magdalene saw Jesus, John had looked in the tomb. He saw the neatly arranged grave cloths and concluded that it was not a grave robber. And John tells us he looked and he believed. And yet Mark describes him being one of the 10 disputing Mary Magdalene's testimony. Now this makes us wonder, what exactly did John believe? Because he's come to understand something, but he hasn't seen the whole picture, because he says, no, Mary, you're wrong.
He just come back from flood.
Yeah, that was the issue. So now let's look a little further. In verses 12 and 13, the 10 believe the 2 travelers. Remember how Luke gives the account of the men on the road to Emmaus. This is a very condensed version of that. After that, he appeared in another form to 2 of them as they walked and went into the country. And they went and told the rest, but they didn't believe them either. So now we're going to have Jesus come, and Jesus is going to rebuke the 10 for their disbelief of multiple attestation. There were multiple witnesses. They should have believed there was sufficient evidence, besides which Jesus had prophesied that he would be raised on a number of occasions in the presence of his disciples. So, in verse 14, he rebukes them for their disbelief. Later, he appeared to the 11 as they sat at the table, and he rebuked their unbelief. And notice how much emphasis there has been on the unbelief of the 10. And hardness of heart, because they did not believe those who had seen him after he had risen. Verse 15, he commanded them to proclaim the message, but the message is going to focus upon he has been raised. But verse 15, we have to understand that very carefully. Or verse 16, rather. Verse 16 is often understood as saying that people have to believe and be baptized in order to get eternal life. That is not at all what the passage is talking about. Not at all. He is talking to the 10, and he is saying to them, and these are people who have already believed in him for everlasting life, he is saying to them, you need to believe what I'm telling you. And you need to be baptized. But the baptism he's talking about is not a water baptism. It is a kind of baptism that Jesus prophesied in Mark chapter 10. It's not Holy Spirit baptism either. But I've put in brackets words that I would add for clarification. Whenever in my notes I have brackets, it's saying you won't find those words in the verse we're looking at. These are words that I've supplied. Jesus said that whoever, in brackets, of the 11 believed, in brackets, his command, verse 15, and would be baptized, brackets, into suffering for him, would be delivered in this life. But he who continues disbelieving his command would face discipline. Now, let's look for the evidence that that would be the interpretation. I'll read the verse first. He who believes and is baptized will be delivered, but he who does not believe will be condemned, will be judged, will face discipline. Let's go back to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, you may remember that the sons of Zebedee asked via their mother, will you let one of us sit at your right hand and one at your left? In other words, make us number one and number two. Let's cut Peter out of this. He can be number three. And so when they asked that, Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. And he had a number of things to say to them. We'll start at verse 36. Jesus said to them, what do you want me to do for you? They said to him, grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and one on your left in your glory. In other words, number one and number two assistants. Verse 38, Jesus said to them, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They said, we are able. They greatly underestimated. So Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it's prepared. You'll need to go through the Bema seat. You'll need to be evaluated. Then that will be determined whether this is for you. But he said, you will be baptized with my baptism, and you will be you will drink my cup. And you remember at Gethsemane, Jesus said, let this cup pass from me. Let it pass from me to the disciples. They were going to suffer as they stood up for him. And so we look at this passage back in Mark chapter 16. Stop disbelieving. If you believe what I've just told you, and you then enter into that ministry and you suffer on my behalf, you're baptized into that, you will be delivered. You'll be delivered in this life.
Is that verse directed just to those 10?
Just to those 10. That is it. We'll see confirmation of that a few moments later. But he who does not believe, and can you imagine? They're thinking right now, Thomas? Uh-oh, Thomas. And so when we go to John chapter 20, you look at that and you see how they were pleading with Thomas. They were saying, get with the program, Thomas. He said, it's going to have severe consequences if you continue to reject this. It's a very interesting look at chapter 20 in this regard. He will be judged. So now what he does is he promises accompanying signs for those of the 11 that believe, those of the 11 that go forth on this. And these signs will accompany those who believe. This is for you 10. In my name they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will pick up serpents, and if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. Every one of these, except for the drinking of poison, is recorded in the New Testament of the apostles. He's saying, even if you're forced to drink poison, even if you are put into a pit with poisonous snakes, you will survive as long as I want you ministry. Now look at the evidence that this is the direction this was going. In verse 19, and 20, he ascended. Confirmatory signs accompanied them as they preached. So then, after the Lord had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. And they went out and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word through the accompanying signs. Those signs were designed to validate, to verify the apostles' message. Now let's back up a little bit. Remember, John's gospel contains around 8 signs that prove Jesus is the Messiah. It is a lower class of signs, but still important signs that validate the message of the apostles. They had to go out, they had to carry a message, and it needed confirmation. You might jot down Hebrews chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Pastor Dix went over that passage a while back, and that passage is saying that God confirmed the New Testament through signs, wonders, and gifts. That is completely in accordance with this. So, when we think of the 10, here they are puzzling over, okay, Jesus has been crucified. What's next for him and what's next for us? And we see them running around, locking themselves behind closed doors and not knowing what to do. Jesus gives them something to do, but what he gives them to do is going to require them to come out from hiding, and they are going to have to take great risks carrying a message forth to a world that would be in opposition to them. Let's do a recap, and that recap is going to lead us, I think, to the conclusion that what they did not understand, even after the cross, was that Jesus wasn't going straight from the grave to be with the Father, never to see them again. But he was indeed going to be on earth for 40 days, ministering to them and preparing them for the ministry that they had, to proclaim the resurrection. But think about it. What would you think if up until Jesus has come into the room, you thought, he went up to heaven, what am I supposed to do? And now they see him, and they say, he's been resurrected. Yes, he's going to go, he will be ascended. But he is preparing them. Can you imagine the excitement that they would go out in proclaiming a crucified and resurrected Savior? And that's what we have to bear in mind when we look at the Gospel of John. We come in there and we look and we say, we know he's going to be raised. We know he's going to spend 40 days with them. And we look and we have a hard time identifying with how shocking this truth was for the disciples when they realized it. Can you imagine the excitement with which they carried the message? Okay, let's look at this recap. Prior to the cross, the 11 did not believe that Jesus would die. We've seen that. Neither, therefore, did they believe that he would be resurrected. If he didn't die, he wouldn't need to be resurrected. So they rejected that. When the Apostle John saw the neatly folded grave cloths, he believed, but I'm sure he thought, okay, Jesus is already in heaven. And he wasn't expecting to see him. Later, John and the others disbelieved reports by people who had seen the risen Jesus. So what did John and 10 believe prior to seeing him? Well, he went straight up. Ascension and resurrection and ascension were combined into one event. I find an interesting clue in John 20:17 as to what the disciples had believed in Jesus speaking with Mary Magdalene. He says there, "Stop clinging to me. You don't have to hold on to me. I'm not like helium. I'm not trying to ascend right now. I'm fixing to." So when he says, "I have not yet ascended," it's like in Texas, "I'm fixing to." He's still here. He's going to be with them for the 40 days. He's going to prepare them. They are going to be ready to carry forth that message. But notice he says, "Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended." I'm fixing to, but I'm not yet doing it. "But go to my brethren and say to them, I am," that is, "I'm fixing to ascend to my Father and to your Father, to my God and to your God." Jesus has work to do. He has to prepare the 11. So let's now look at a sermon that Peter delivered that I think dovetails very nicely with John. In Acts chapter 2, verses 29 to 36, in his Pentecost sermon, he talks about both resurrection and ascension. He says to Jewish people, mainly unbelievers, "Men and brethren, let me speak to you freely of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried. His tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet and knowing that God is sworn with an oath to him that the fruit of his body according to the flesh he would raise up," ascension, "for the Christ to sit on his throne, he, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection," and I would take that as a reference to the resurrection of the Christ, "that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus, God has raised up," and it's ascension here because he's saying we are witnesses. We actually saw it, which in Acts chapter 1, the rest of the disciples saw that. They didn't actually see him resurrected, but he's saying we saw it, "of which we are all witnesses. Therefore, being exalted, ascension to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Spirit, he poured out this, which you now see and hear," where people were speaking in foreign languages supernaturally on the day of Pentecost. "For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he says himself, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, till I make your enemies a footstool.'" And then we have verse 36, which sounds like the purpose statement in John. Listen to it. "Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly." To know something assuredly is to believe it. "Let them believe that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." Notice how similar that is to John 20:31. I've recorded 30 and 31 below. "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these 8 signs are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." The resurrection and the ascension are great proofs of who Jesus is. Next slide. John says that he's recorded... One more? Sorry. Okay, here we go. Remember those 8 signs? Agua, boy, cock. Think your way through those. All those signs are written so you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. The reader, the intended reader for this book, this is an entirely new concept. As I've argued, John wrote this book early. He wrote it so early, according to John 21:24, that the rest of the apostles were able to give it their good housekeeping seal of approval. They said they knew it was true. John's gospel, in my opinion, could very well be the first book of the New Testament written. I would have no problem with it being written by the year 35, 2 years after Jesus was raised. That message needed to go out, and it would be reinforced by these disciples who are absolutely flabbergasted by, look at what Jesus has done. He says it, and it happens. Every one of those signs, including cross and resurrection. He is the greater than Moses prophet like Moses. So imagine yourself as a first century reader. We have to look at John with new eyes. And when we talk to unbelievers, we should capture the wonderment of this book to entice them to read about this one who guarantees everlasting life. Next slide. I told you about how Frank Tyler talked with that man who was an atheist. And when he asked him the question, would you like to know if you'd live forever? And he thought, you know, that would be a good thing to be able to know. And with that thought on his mind, he then, even as an atheist, was willing to look at the book that makes a case for God, the God who gives everlasting life to those who believe his son for it. So we haven't spent a lot of time in John's Gospel today, but I wanted to set up the wonderment of what those disciples saw, because they didn't anticipate the ending of this story. And because of how amazing a picture that was able to be presented before them, they went out and they turned the world upside down with a message from God. That is the same message that we have in John's Gospel. How can we not be excited about this? Any questions? Steve.
You know, just having Sunday meeting Sunday to do this to remember, I've often wondered what the apostles, their second communion was different than the first one.
I'm sure it was. I am sure it was. You know, talking about communion, as I look at John 6, I see something a little different than we often see with it. Now, John 6 is not a communion passage. It's a Passover passage. But since 1 year later he instituted the Lord's table, it is drawing upon Passover imagery. So I don't feel at all uncomfortable in saying that there's a relationship between the two. But it's interesting. He said that the one who believes in him has everlasting life. But he also said, unless one eats of his flesh and drinks of his blood, I forget the exact wording, but he said that was necessary for having everlasting life. Eating and drinking are pictures of believing. But what is it when we think of flesh and blood? Whole person. We get so focused on there are two elements. The bread, which pictures his body, and the juice, which pictures his blood. But in John chapter 6, he seems to talk about putting the two together, because notice, eating and drinking are compared with believing in him. He didn't put it as believing in his flesh and believing in his blood. It was believing in him. I mean, we so often have the two elements so separated that we fail to see that Jesus was looking at flesh and blood together, believing in him, which I find to be a fascinating, a little bit of food for thought. I saw another hand. Right. Yes.
Yeah. You spoke of 10 disciples and 11 disciples.
Okay.
10 plus John?
Okay. 10 plus Thomas.
Thomas, okay.
Because when we read in John chapter 20, there was one meeting that is described in the first part of chapter 20, and it tells us specifically Thomas was not there. So we had 10. Mm-hmm. And then there was a later meeting, a week later, and Thomas joined them. So, yeah, that's the reason that I've referred to the ten, is because we're told explicitly that Thomas was not present.
Okay, thank you.
Now, there are some times in the New Testament, the 12 is referred to as a whole group, and the 11 is referred to as a whole group. Sometimes, though, it's demonstrable that less of them were there than 11, or less were there than the 12, but yet 11 and 12 are fixed numbers for the whole group. Any other questions?
John, real quick, just so everybody understands, and what a great presentation you did, and I thank you so much, brother. Because it's set, a lot of people so misunderstand that Mark 16.
Yes.
And, you know, the promise that, you know, and I just, you did a good job doing it, but just one more time to reinforce that's not a promise that we can go out and drink poison and that sort of stuff. And why is that? So everybody understands this because they'll hear from, you know, Pentecostals and stuff like that.
When we think about this passage, the emphasis was the ten were in disbelief. They were rejecting everyone that was saying, we've seen him. He's risen. And they were rejecting it over and over and over again. Jesus rebuked them for their disbelief. Not in the concept of not having believed him for everlasting life. We see very clearly in John's gospel that they had believed in him for everlasting life. All 11, that is everyone except for Judas, we see by the time that Jesus starts his last discourse in John 13, they had all believed in him for everlasting life. But they had not all believed in his resurrection. And so he is rebuking them for their rejection of his resurrection, something he had predicted many times, and now there were eyewitnesses. So in that context, he's saying, you need to believe this that I'm saying, and you need to be baptized into it in the sense of going out and suffering for carrying that message forth. But as they carried that message forth, the whole world would be opposed to them. The Jewish leadership, the Roman authorities, they'd have everybody against them. And they would be standing up in court trials. Remember how Jesus said that people are going to think they're doing God service by killing you and kicking you out of the synagogues. And so the deliverance he talks about here is they are going to stay alive as long as God wants them ministering. It is a promise to the apostles. We see good evidence that it was a promise to the apostles by looking at verse 20 of chapter 16 in Mark. They went out and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word through the accompanying signs. These are signs designed to confirm the message for those who would believe the message. And so the belief here is not the belief of those who will hear these people. It is the belief of these ten in what Jesus has commanded right here. Okay, any further questions?
One more.
Yes,
so,
Paul.
Getting back into like the historical context of what you tried to do for it, to kind of get into their head, like what it was like for them in that day. With the resurrection, is it almost as simple as kind of saying to yourself, well, they saw him and they acknowledged him as God, and they just couldn't perceive how God gets killed. I mean, is that part of the rejection of the, you know, they're like, okay, well, God can't get killed. Nobody can kill God, so, and we do believe he is God, so the resurrection just like, yeah, that, you know, no, that can't happen because he can't die. Is that their mindset?
That may well have been the mindset for some of them. I think that John chapter 12, where the question comes up, well, if the Messiah dies, then how can the Messiah live forever.
Mm-hmm. And no so, idea of a temporary
thing. So not understanding that death is not a permanent estate for him. Mm-hmm. They say, okay, if he dies, that looks like it.
Yeah.
And so the answer to the thing there where they say, well, you can't be talking about the Messiah when you're talking about Son of Man, because you say the Son of Man is going to be lifted up, that is, he's going to die, and yet the Messiah has to remain forever.
And even with the example of Lazarus that they had shown him, where he kind of did demonstrate that somebody could die and come back,
sure,
they still weren't really getting that?
No, they didn't. One of the taunts when Jesus was on the cross is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It shows up in the Synoptics where it says, he delivered others, mm-hmm, he cannot deliver himself. Mm-hmm. They could say, well, it's one thing to raise Lazarus, but what do you do when you're dead? Mm-hmm. And there's a crescendo in the signs. The signs keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. There's a tremendous step up from Lazarus to the cross and resurrection, because Lazarus received raising, whereas Jesus rose. I mean, what a powerful apologetic we've got.
Would it be fair to say that they also were influenced by the crowds, and obviously the crowds were looking for a nationalistic deliverer. They were looking for, again, someone to, put them back in power and get Rome out.
Yeah, they obviously didn't have the timeline that he takes care of one thing at a time.
Right.
There were a lot of features going on. And yes, that would...
Yeah, they wanted Jesus to be who they wanted him to be.
Right.
Conquering David kind of military dude.
As far as the crowds go.
Yes.
Didn't part of the Jews believe in resurrection?
Oh, yes.
So was it a different resurrection? What was that belief?
It didn't involve the Messiah being resurrected.
Okay.
Paul in Acts 26 makes a fascinating statement there as he is defending himself in a situation where part of the group believes in the resurrection and part does not. I mean, I find it absolutely fascinating the nature of the argument that Paul makes in Acts 26. Agrippa told him that he was permitted to speak for himself, and so he said, I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because today I shall answer for myself before you concerning all the things of which I am accused by the Judeans, especially because you are expert in all customs and questions which have to do with the Judeans. Therefore I beg you hear me patiently. My manner of life from my youth was spent from the beginning among my own nation at Jerusalem. All the Judeans know. They knew me from the first, if they were willing to testify that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope, the expectation, of the promise made by God to our fathers. To this promise, our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. For this hope's sake, I am accused by the Judeans. Why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? What he's saying is, the hope of Israel is summarized in the Abrahamic covenant. God promised, this land I give to you, and to your seed forever. He didn't just say, I'm giving it to your seed. But he told Abraham. He also told Isaac. And he told Jacob, I'm giving it to you and to your seed forever. If Abraham were rotting in a tomb, never to be raised, and not to possess everlasting life, it's a hollow promise to say, I'm giving it to you and to your seed. Hebrews 11 tells us, all these died in faith without having received the promises. God would be a liar without the resurrection. It's the only way he can fulfill his promises. So notice how Paul concludes this. He says, why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead? apart from raising the dead, God can't fulfill the hope of Israel. The hope of Israel requires resurrection, and it requires everlasting life.
What was that passage you were reading?
Acts 26.
26:8.
Yeah, starting at verse 1. And so Paul says, here I am, and fundamentally, I am here because I stand up for the resurrection, and yet, if you reject the resurrection, you've also rejected the hope of Israel.
Yeah.
So he says, this is a contradictory position.